Hi, this is Robert Scheer with another edition of Scheer Intelligence and the Intelligence Customer. My guest in this case, someone I've interviewed before, Danny Shorson. He graduated from West Point. What year was that about?
2005.
But when he first went into West Point, soon after, there was the 9/11 attack. And then after he graduated, because of 9/11, the war in Afghanistan and Iraq, or at least the excuse to go to war in Iraq and then in Afghanistan. He served and served off and on for the 18 years that followed his your first entry into West Point. And then he went back and taught at West Point as an instructor. And then he was also sent by the Army to get his doctorate, because the best soldiers have doctorates. And he's written a number of very important books. One was Ghost Riders of Baghdad, about his experience there. He's got an overall history of the military history of the United States that should be coming out in about 6 months. He's got a book on patriotism that's coming out in a couple of months, 3 months. And his doctoral dissertation should be published, and it's on a different subject than War and Peace. It's War and Peace in Staten Island with racism as the fuel that caused tension and so forth. So it's really great to have you back. And the reason I hustled you into this radio studio at the Annenberg School of Communication and Journalism at USC is because something happened in the news March 5th. And it was announced that the International Criminal Court, and I'm going to let Major Danny Shorson, retired, talk all about it. But the International Criminal Court in The Hague, which is there to investigate charges of genocide, war crimes, crimes against humanity, and which the United States has resisted joining. And I'll let him tell that story. But they finally decided they are going to investigate the U.S. behavior, along with that of the Taliban that we've now negotiating peace with, and the existing Afghan government, to see whether war crimes, crimes against humanity. It had been delayed largely under pressure from the United States, but the chief prosecutor, who's made the case that she has compelling evidence, finally the High Court in The Hague allowed it to go through. And, you know, the U.S. government, the Trump administration, has said, first of all, they revoked any kind of visa for that prosecutor to come to the United States. They branded our Secretary of State, and I'll let Major Shorson talk about it, but our Secretary of State has condemned the court and so forth. But it really goes to a more basic question. We, the U.S. that launched this whole idea of war crimes in modern history with the Nuremberg trials, has actually refused to be held accountable of this. And long before Trump, very respectable members of the U.S. Congress, including Joe Biden, now the candidate for president, former vice president, Dianne Feinstein, the senator from California, not Bernie Sanders. He voted against it. Give him a marker for that when he was in the House. But they voted for a piece of legislation back in 2002, which said, you know, we're not going to follow what this court says. So why don't you take it from there, Major Shorson?
Right. So, you know, as a historian, as well as someone with experience in Afghanistan, I look at this from two angles. And I think the important part is the history. You know, this story that broke today could easily be seen as an indictment of Trump and his flouting of international law. But what I want to talk about, you know, and it is that, but what I want to talk about is the lengthy history of American flouting of this ICC. And so in order to understand that, we have to understand that, you know, the ICC is originally signed as part of the Rome Statute in 1998 to do the things that you mentioned, right? Prosecute genocide. I mean, it really only is a court of last resort. It's only supposed to exist or take precedence if another country refuses to investigate or if the UN Security Council refers the case, which, of course, it never will against Americans because we're on the Security Council. Now, only seven countries in the world voted against the ICC.
International Criminal Court.
The International Criminal Court in The Hague, which now, as you said, wants to investigate potential war crimes in Afghanistan by us as well as the Taliban and the government. Well, we were an interesting company in voting. We voted against the ICC, although we later signed it. It was us, China, Iraq, Israel, Libya, Yemen, and Qatar. So interesting company to be in. We do sign on, though, after voting against it. Now, here's where it gets really interesting. Even before the ICC actually comes to force, which is July of 02, so it's signed in 98, but it takes until, you know, it's not supposed to come into force, and it doesn't until 2002. After September 11th, Congress, first in the House, then in the Senate, passes with large majorities, mostly bipartisan, something called the American Service Members Protection Act. This is still law, okay? And what it said was that, I mean, I'll just quote one sentence from the bill. It authorized the U.S. president to use, quote, all means necessary and appropriate to bring about the release of any U.S. or allied military personnel being detained or imprisoned by or on behalf of or request of the ICC. So what this means, and critics have called it, and I think accurately, the Hague Invasion Act. This was an authorization for the use of military force that reads just like the authorization for military force in Iraq. It says that, you know, if any American soldier is ever held there or even requested to be held there or on behalf of the ICC, that we can invade it. And this is sort of remarkable. And I think what's particularly remarkable about it is that this bill is signed in the House and the Senate before the ICC even comes to power. So here's preemption again, right? The same internationally illegal doctrine after the Nuremberg principles that we used to invade Iraq. So who, you know, who voted for it? You know, you mentioned a few names, but in the Senate, Joe Biden, Hillary Clinton, Chuck Schumer, Mitch McConnell, John Kerry. So the big wigs in the mainstream Democratic Party, many of whom are still prominent,
and
voted,
the Republican Party too.
And the Republican Party as well. Yeah, of course. You know, although in the Senate, the few people who voted against it tended to be more libertarian-minded Republicans. But there were nay votes, and in the House, those nay votes, there were a lot of Democrats. We must say that Nancy Pelosi voted against it, but of course so did Bernie Sanders, and then some Republicans like Paul Ryan and Dana Rohrabacher. But, you know, the takeaway on this is that what are the implications? It's still law, meaning that three different presidential administrations, starting with Bush, including Obama, have maintained this posture of potential military invasion, or at least the flouting of the court regardless. Multiple Congresses, which were under the control of different parties at different times. So this is not just the Trump story. And I fear that it's going to be covered, this Afghanistan investigation is going to be covered as a Trump administration flouting of international law. And again, it is that. But it's really a longer American tradition.
Well, let's look at that tradition. Now, what is the title of this law that preempted the, or tried to preempt the International Criminal Court?
It is called the American Service Members Protection Act.
Okay. Now, you were one of those American service members. And would you have welcomed, did you need protection against a court looking into charges that you engaged in genocide, a killing of civilians, crimes against humanity? Because that's what, I mean, we are asking for something that would have prevented the Nuremberg principle from being applied. And you were a lieutenant, a captain, and then a major in command of troops in Iraq first, and then in Afghanistan, where this current investigation is aimed. Do you think that American servicemen in Afghanistan needed protection against the rule of law and an international court operating in The Hague in case they committed what others thought were war crimes?
Of course not. This was a farce. The notion that we were under some sort of danger, that we were the victims, that we needed to be protected from being extradited to The Hague, that for a number of reasons, some practical, I mean, it wouldn't have happened. But also, this again is a court that, by its statute, is a court of last resort. Well, the Uniform Code of Military Justice that governs the U.S. military, at least, you know, in theory, already prohibits any of these genocidal actions or war crimes. So the notion that we had to preempt the ICC and thereby really stick a finger in the eye of flouting international law, you know, even before it comes into force, is ridiculous. I mean, in some ways, it's actually insulting because, you know, the implication then from Congress is that, you know, you know, we're not going to do our job and prosecute and maintain our own good order and discipline. And therefore, the ICC might, you know, send its, you know, black helicopters supposedly that they don't have to pick us up in Afghanistan and prosecute us in The Hague. And that's ridiculous.
But let's pause for a second and consider this, because I've heard you speak on this subject and you've talked about American triumphalism and American exceptionalism. We have this idea, almost by definition, that if it's done by people representing the U.S. government, whether as diplomats or CIA agents or troops in the field, it can't really be a war crime. Because this investigation started on the part of the Hague prosecutor, who's had her travel document visa revoked by the U.S. and denounced. You should go through some of the denunciation by our Secretary of State, who, like you, is a West Point graduate, so he knows something about the Army's code of behavior. And yet, her investigation, we're originally into the torture program. What did we do in Afghanistan? And since you have this reality check, why don't you connect us with being in Afghanistan? You were there. Tell us where you were, and tell us about the omnipresent reality of maybe genocide, crimes, torture. We know it was part of the landscape.
Well, you know, certainly I was in Afghanistan in rural Kandahar province, the heartland of the Taliban, from 2011 till 12 for a year. And I'm glad that this ICC investigation is looking at all parties, you know, the Afghan government, Taliban, and the United States, because I really do think that, you know, across the breadth of this war, there were certainly human rights violations, maybe war crimes, quite certainly, maybe not genocide. And, you know, to me, this whole idea of, you know, passing a law to, you know, invade The Hague if necessary is the ultimate manifestation of what empires do. Empires like I carried water for in Afghanistan. You know, what they do, the three things that I've kind of coined that, you know, define imperial behavior is triumphalism, which is based on exceptionalism, which manifests itself through chauvinism, right? So triumphalism, exceptionalism, and chauvinism. Now, this law, the American Service Protections Act, the Hague Invasion Act, if you want to call it that, to me, is the it's completely forgotten, by the way. I mean, almost no one remembers that this was passed and is still law. But it is the ultimate manifestation of that. I mean, it's the logical conclusion of that sort of triumphalism and chauvinism. Look, most
now,
of...
Let me just be clear about something. Because this law is still in effect. So, in fact, if Donald Trump, our president, does, in fact, invade The Hague, because he says they're jeopardizing an American soldier by bringing that soldier to trial, say that soldier has blown up an orphanage or something, you know, very obvious, very extreme violation of the Army's own rules of engagement, but no charges were brought against him. And he could say, I'm not doing anything that I wasn't instructed to do, as were previous presidents, by legislation that my opponent in this race, one of my opponents, not both of them, likely opponents, but certainly Joe Biden, he signed off on this. He gave me this power. Chuck Schumer, another leading Democrat, Hillary Clinton, they all gave me this power. Bernie Sanders didn't. Nancy Pelosi didn't. So, you know, there were people, saner minds. On the other hand, Dianne Feinstein also voted for it, had big majorities. And he could say, because everybody wants to blame everything ugly and bad, you know, it's easier on your opponent. But why did Joe Biden sign off on this? What is the thinking? Why would you protect someone? And we're not talking about being dragged into just any old court in any old country. You can see where you want some protection about that. You know, a soldier is traveling through China or Egypt or anywhere, you want to give them protection. We're talking about the International Criminal Court, which has acted responsibly all these years. It's taken them, in this case, to investigate what happened in 03, 04, all of this time, right? And you get to go into court. These people who are charged, they'll have their own lawyers, they can challenge it. So you're writing a book that's coming out soon on whether patriotism is toxic. I'll just summarize my sense of this book. I know something about it. This is an example of the appeal of patriotism. George Washington is the one who warned us in his farewell address about the impostures of pretended patriotism. Well, this is pretended patriotism. It's saying, I am going to defend an American soldier from any court, international or otherwise, no matter what they're charged with doing, and I'm going to do it in the name of patriotism.
Right. I mean, this, the whole thinking is a my country right or wrong thinking. You know, we are above the law. It's that exceptionalism that is going to manifest itself through military chauvinism if we have to invade The Hague. Now, what was the thinking? Now, I happen to think that the timeline of all this, the ratification and when these acts were put into place, is both instructive and disturbing. And it gets to what Joe Biden might have been thinking, right? What the 77 bipartisan votes in favor in the Senate might have been thinking. Well, you know, this law, the Service Members Protection Act, the Hague Invasion Act, is put into place or is first brought before the Congress soon after 9/11 and before the ICC even takes effect. Now, what did we know based on law we signed 3 days after the towers come down? On September 14th, we signed a law that basically authorizes the president to go after al-Qaeda. But it's very vague, and we know. I think guys like Joe Biden, Hillary Clinton were very aware that the U.S. military is about to run rampant in the Middle East. It's about to do whatever the heck it thinks it needs to do in order to, you know, stamp out terrorism. So preemptively, I think there's a fear that, you know, if we don't punish some of our guys, if they get out of order, or some of our allies, these militias and warlords that we're going to operate through, we might face an awkward situation where U.S. troops or a U.S. general or even a U.S. civilian official in the Bush administration might get called before this court. So preemptively, we're going to sign a bill that says no. No, American values are so superior to everyone else in the world that no one else gets to dictate to us what international norms are, what international law is. And so I think that does drive it, and I think it is a manifestation of this triumphalism, exceptionalism, and chauvinism. But the thing about this prosecutor is that she already has done a 10-year cursory, or not even cursory, initial investigation, and she has evidence that she claims is very strong, and the court clearly agreed with her, that there's something worth looking into, especially in 2003-04, with regard to war crimes, especially by CIA and special forces backed, trained, armed, and sometimes advised on the ground militias with regarding rape and prisoner abuse, torture, and killing. So she isn't just pulling this out of nowhere. This is the product of a 10-year initial investigation. Well, and she's only been authorized to investigate further. That's all she's been authorized to do.
Yeah, and that's why they're attacking her. And you make a good point, because it's not only what U.S. soldiers directly under the command of someone like yourself, who was a major there, but also we're giving cover for the Afghan army that's on our side, for anyone else who we say on our side. And one of the ironies here we should mention, not to go into the whole history of the Afghan War, which is the longest war in U.S. history, more than World War II, World War I, and the Korean War combined, 18 years of this, that basically we went after the bad actors of al-Qaeda, who were their people that we encouraged, along with Saudi Arabia and other places, to go there in the first place to Afghanistan. They were Arabs. They were not Pashtuns. They were not from the region. And they went there to fight the Soviets who had invaded Afghanistan, because it was actually at the invitation of a government in Afghanistan that was quite sympathetic to the Soviets. But nonetheless, and the history has shown, we have very good record documentation that the U.S. was involved there before the Soviets, on the side of these same Mujahideen, and that we actively, our CIA, actively recruited the people who became al-Qaeda. That's not a fantasy. It's not some wild conspiracy theory. That's well documented, and we even know that even under a president that I actually personally like, Jimmy Carter, that his national security advisor, Zbigniew Brzezinski, was very proud of this, and he said, you know, this we wanted to give the Russians, the Soviets, their Vietnam, and this was good, and so what if a bunch of crazed Muslims caused some damage after? And then General Gates, who was actually Secretary of Defense at that time, defended it and actually pointed out in his autobiography that the U.S. troops were there before the Soviets invaded. So we have this crazy situation where we are actually as a society, American taxpayers and their government, responsible for really a lot of the troubles and disturbance and madness, including these foreign, Zbigniew Brzezinski's words, hopped up Muslims who came there, Arabs. And yet, when we go there to supposedly save democracy and freedom, and here I want you to talk about your own experience, we are frightened that there actually could be an international investigation and of the Taliban, yes, of the bad actors in our old language, which we're now making peace with, but the Afghan government and the U.S. government. And that's what we're frightened of, that the U.S. will be suddenly subject to the very standard that we proclaim for the world.
Well, what you point out are really interesting irony, which is that I was on the ground and my soldiers and a million other American soldiers right over the course of this war to fight an enemy that we helped create. And then in the process of fighting that enemy, when war crimes were committed, we then are afraid we might be brought to justice. So this is really ironic. And just one example is, you know, when I teach classes, I show a slide that has a picture of Ronald Reagan sitting around.
This is a class you were teaching at West Point.
Yes, even at West Point. You want to talk? It's crazy what I was able to get away with. Luckily, very rarely was anybody watching, and I had a great boss. But anyway, you know, I would show at West Point, and even now, you know, I showed it in a class here at USC last night, an interesting photo. On one slide of Reagan in the Oval Office with a room full of bearded Mujahideen leaders, some of whom were killed, but many of whom, really to a man, ended up being Taliban supporters later, fighting against American soldiers. And their sons, of course, who are still alive, are leaders. And then on the same slide, I will show an article from the 1980s from The Independent, right, the newspaper The Independent, not an American newspaper, but that refers to bin Laden as an anti-Soviet warrior. It's a biopic piece almost that is very positive about him. Has a picture of him in Afghanistan, and even has a quote of his, you know, highlighted in bold. So this is the thing. But you know, I can speak to my own experience in Afghanistan. I did not witness a lot of what I would describe as war crimes from conventional U.S. soldiers that were under my command that I can speak for, or my adjacent units. But I was witness to Afghan army war crimes. Specifically, I can speak to rape and prisoner abuse. Prisoner abuse of Taliban prisoners, and actually prisoner abuse of their own soldiers who would desert or really just do anything that they found illegal. I mean, I watched it, right?
And I didn't watch it because you were there as an ally.
I was there as an ally. I was in command of my own small outpost in the heartland of the Taliban. I had about 100 to 120 soldiers under my command, American soldiers on any given day, but also living on my little outpost was about 100 Afghan army soldiers who I didn't directly command, but I was in a very interesting command relationship where I was supposed to work together with this like 55-year-old captain who had fought the Soviets, but he was on the Afghan government side. So I observed him commit war crimes against prisoners and his own and Taliban. A lot of these guys were rapists. My soldiers had to drag one of our interpreters out of a rape, out of a sexual assault, when the Afghan army soldiers were in the midst of tearing his clothes off. So, I mean, I saw a lot of this stuff. Quite frankly, I was in some ways party to it because in some cases I didn't stop it soon enough, although I did always step in once I had the knowledge. So then, of course, in the course of my study, I came to understand that this was widespread. And specifically in more of the special operations and CIA community, when we largely got a lot of the dirty work done, what Dick Cheney called the dark side, right? A lot of the dirty work in Afghanistan got done by our proxies. And these were warlords trained, armed, and sometimes led by the CIA and the special forces. And we know, right, in unclassified sources that some of these guys, these warlord militias, I mean, they murdered, in some cases, thousands of prisoners, some suffocated, mass abuses against the civilian, and of course, Taliban prisoners. And so this is what, you know, she's really looking at. But what I think is interesting is that all this appeals court,
she being
the prosecutor
from the International Criminal
that's
Court,
correct.
That the U.S. is threatening to invade should they dare bring a charge against an American, right?
You know, you asked me to maybe hit just a couple of very brief statements from some of the top bigwigs in the U.S. government right now, how they feel about the ICC. And for any Shakespeare fans out there, I think that Pompeo and Bolton, who's no longer in the government, maybe the ladies doth protest too much, because all this court ruling that came out today says is that Fatou Bensouda, the prosecutor, she's allowed to open a probe. That's all she's allowed to do. She's just going to, this only allows her to open a probe, and we're freaking out, right? And so Pompeo says in the article today that this is a truly breathtaking action by an unaccountable political institution masquerading as a legal body. And he is speaking about the ICC, the International Criminal Court. He also says it's reckless that this ruling came out just days after the U.S. signed a historic peace deal. Now, I do think the peace deal is hopefully a step in the right direction. But this is interesting because that's an illogical statement. This investigation is not looking at what's happening this moment. It's looking at the breadth of war crimes over the course of 18 years. So it's irrelevant what he's saying. You know, he's saying this shouldn't be happening because we just signed a peace deal. But okay, that's not what it's looking into.
You graduated from West Point. I don't know what your number was.
I do.
You did all right? Mm-hmm. Huh?
I was number 82 out of 911 graduates, so I was higher than average.
That's pretty good, 82 out of 900.
I was high enough that I could choose any job in the Army and almost any base.
And you went back and you were an instructor, a professor, a teacher at West Point. I think you did that, what, for 4 years?
It was a total four-year assignment, including education, yeah.
And now Pompeo, who is our Secretary of State, he was number one in the class.
That's right.
So he's a bright guy. Mm-hmm. And even though he's reviled as a Republican and people criticize him for being too close to Trump and so forth, but how does he square that? You have a code of behavior in the Army. You had one at West Point. You're educated. And here he is violating all that. And he actually, didn't he make a statement once saying, well, forget what I was taught at West Point. There's another code of behavior.
Well, that's right. One of the things that I talk about fairly regularly is this honor code that we're taught at West Point. The minute we walk through the gates and we have to memorize it, and I'll never forget it, right? And he hasn't forgotten it either because he's quoted it. A cadet will not lie, cheat, steal, nor tolerate those who do. And I think the last part is perhaps the most important. The toleration clause, nor tolerate those who do. So when Mike Pompeo, class of 1986, a classmate of our current Secretary of Defense, Mark Esper, by the way, when Pompeo, class of 86, takes over the CIA, he does at one point give a talk, I believe at a university, where he mentions, you know, hey, I was taught this honor code, lie, cheat, steal, don't do it. But, you know, as head of the CIA, we teach classes on exactly how to lie, cheat, steal. It's part of our business. Mike Pompeo, quite frankly, you know, not to engage in any ad hominem, but to me, you know, he's the sort of West Point grad or the sort of person who uses West Point credentials that I most take issue with, in the sense that, you know, he's wildly militaristic without himself having been in combat, but not that that precludes him from having good ideas. But, you know, this is a guy who was deep in Koch Industries. You know, now he's at CIA and Secretary of State. He's been deep in the military-industrial complex. And now he's saying,
and he,
you know,
actually never was in combat. Right?
He never was. No, he graduated in 1986. He did his five-year mandatory bid, missed out on the Gulf War. I mean, it's not really his fault. He happened to graduate a timepiece, but he chose not to stay in the Army. Most don't. About 50% leave any given after their 5 years in any given graduating class. But yeah, so he and Esper didn't see any real combat. And yet, you know, these are some of the most hawkish guys, which is just, you know, that term has been thrown around a lot, chicken hawk, but certainly this is a guy who, yes, he did serve his country and he deserves some credit for that, but, you know, he's very hawkish without having himself seen a shot fired in anger. I have, as well as the war crimes that I've witnessed. He hasn't witnessed any of those, and yet he's not even willing to allow an investigation into potential of war crimes by the three major parties in this war. And I find that relatively abhorrent. And I think he's protesting too much because he's afraid of what might be uncovered.
And what about Bolton? Tell us about him. And by the way, it's interesting. This guy, Bolton, was like one of the really far-out neocon hawks and supported it. Never met a war he didn't want to have other people fight. But now he's loved by some of the Democrats who also seem to love war more than they used to. And, right, because he seems to have broken with Trump, and he's got a book coming out that people seem to like because it just, but what did Bolton say about invading, attacking the International Criminal Court?
So Bolton, who I like, my phrase that I like to use about Bolton that's similar to yours is that he never met a regime he didn't want to change. So this guy is full-throated war hawk. He's been the most vocal voice against the ICC since 2002. So unlike Pompeo, he's been talking about this for 16 years.
Against the International Criminal Court,
right,
to investigate crimes anywhere. Not, this is not related directly to the United States. War crimes, including genocide, crimes against humanity, right? Torture.
Just to give you an example of the kind of people this court has prosecuted, I mean, we're talking about Omar Bashir in the Sudan, who is now sort of like a captive to his own country, can't travel. Joseph Kony, the child soldier, messianic warlord in Uganda, who Obama sent troops against. In fact, the first person who was prosecuted and convicted was a lower-level militia figure in Africa who was prosecuted for his use of child soldiers. I mean, so these are going after some pretty bad folks. But Bolton has been the biggest voice against it for a long time. But in 2018, so relatively recently, he was then the national security advisor for Trump. And he said, and I think this is fascinating in a dark way, he said that that the ICC, right, unacceptably threatens American sovereignty and national security interests. I mean, that to me is a bold statement, because I thought that the only thing that threatened American security interests was, you know, nuclear war and the evil Russians and Chinese and terrorism, and, you know, I'm being somewhat facetious there. But he says the ICC is a direct, immediate threat, you know, unacceptable threat to U.S. national security and sovereignty. And boy, if that's not the three aspects of empire come to life, triumphalism, exceptionalism, and chauvinism, I don't know what it is. But the thing to remember is this is not just a Republican and not just a neocon stance. This has been supported by neoliberals and the Democratic Party, establishment figures of the Democratic Party. It's a bipartisan enterprise. Look, Barack Obama could have went to his Congress. He could have made it an issue in his first or second administration, especially the first when he had control of the Congress. He could have said, you know what, guys? In a State of the Union, he could have said, I would like Congress to take another look at this American Service Members Hague Invasion Act, and I would like to stop this because it sends a bad message about the United States. And he didn't do that. He went along to get along. And so this has been a three-administration, multi-Congress, bipartisan enterprise. Bolton and Pompeo are almost refreshingly honest about how they feel about this ICC. I mean, and in that sense, I think that it's almost preferable, because they say what someone like Joe Biden is unlikely to say publicly, but will support through his votes.
Time for a break, and we'll be back in a few minutes. We're back with Sheer Intelligence and our guest. Let me cut to the chase here, because you've written a book about patriotism. What is the title?
Patriotic Descent, America in an Age of Forever War.
Okay, Heyday Books, and it's coming out in, 2 months.
Well, it's not coming out until September, but it is available on Amazon now.
Okay, I mean, they could sign up for
pre-order.
It.
Pre-order, yeah.
Pre-order on Amazon. And it's interesting because, you know, I go to these ball games and you stand up for the flag and you honor the troops and the flag comes out on the football field and everything. And it's so easy. Everybody cheers and they cheer at the high note in the anthem and everything else. And you're somebody who actually went out and did what they're expecting you to do. You ordered and directed people in combat. You saw, you had troops under your command die, right? You blew up buildings in which civilians died. You, in my class the other night, you described a very moving scene in Iraq where you called on a strike and this old man comes out with a dead child to show you what your troops have done, a civilian death. I would argue a war crime. It's so interesting, this disconnect that I guess you would attribute to a notion of American exceptionalism. What were the three elements of this faux patriotism? When I say faux patriotism, again, I want to quote George Washington, who in his farewell address, I don't know, I haven't yet to meet a human being who, when I first brought it up, knew about this. You know, oh, you did, I'm sorry, I apologize, but you're a military historian.
But yes.
But whenever I've asked people, did you know what George Washington, they know what, some people know Eisenhower, another great general, war hero, who became president, who warned us about the military industrial complex and the double standards that apply to that complex and that notion of patriotism. But George Washington, for God's sake, you know, clearly the agreed about great American patriot, warned us of another kind of patriotism. He said, beware the impostures of pretended patriotism. This thing about preventing an international criminal court looking at charges not just of the Taliban and the Afghan government, but of America, oh, that's a no-no. So that means your notion of patriotism is it's the protection of your country, right or wrong. It's the protection of your country's leaders and soldiers and everything, right or wrong, right? So by definition, an American soldier or American CIA agent or anyone else or an American president could not commit a war crime, right? And the fact is, when people have, like Callie and the My Lai massacre, he was punished but then cut loose. No one higher than him was ever really held accountable. The killing of infants, of babies crawling around, shooting them. I mean, one of the, you know, most horrible examples of carnage and, you know, murder of innocents. No real accountability. So your book is really touching, and in this conversation and this using the ICC, the International Criminal Court, as an example, we basically think, and this is what Joe Biden voted for, that no American can be held accountable unless by an American military court. So there's no international accountability. Where there is for all sorts of other things, you know, and there's extradition and so forth, but not, no, if an American is involved in the act of war, and by the way, it's not even a legal war, it was not declared, we don't even acknowledge that we're at war. So take us through this as a historian. Yeah. What does this really mean about what we're asserting about American exceptionalism?
Well, I mean, ultimately, this is us saying that we are above the law. And I also find it somewhat insulting because the implication is that, you know, I can't keep my own soldiers in line, right? That our laws aren't sufficient. But, you know, from a historical perspective, then you mentioned one really important case. One can understand Pompeo and Bolton's fear, but not in the same way that they frame it. It's supposed to be, the ICC is supposed to be the court of last resort when the individual nation responsible is not holding their people to account. Well, if you look at the Cali case in Vietnam, at the My Lai massacre, where hundreds of civilians, including babies, were murdered in a ditch, he really served no time, a little bit of house arrest, full pardon. You look at the Gallagher case, the Navy SEAL who, you know, allegedly murdered a captive. His own SEALs turned him in. This is an extraordinarily rare thing. Sentences have tended historically in America, going back to the Philippine War and others, okay, where there were massive atrocities. One in six Filipinos was killed between 1898 and 1913. No one remembers that war. It used to be our longest war. Used to be our longest war until Afghanistan. Also forgotten. We have a very bad record historically, the United States, of holding our people to account. Guantanamo Bay and Abu Ghraib are another example of that. This all it involves that pageantry patriotism, as I call it, that you described. What I do agree with you is a pornography of flyovers and flags and anthems and disciplining one another to make sure you follow the rules and stand for the pledge and how dare you take a knee. Those soldiers are on the field, and the vast majority of them have not committed war crimes, it must be said, but in some ways they were a party to them because of these preventive wars of choice, right, that oppose the Nuremberg principle, that the highest crime in human behavior is to invade another country when it's unnecessary or when there's no international sanction. Look, there are some inconvenient things that never get mentioned when all those soldiers are on the field. We never actually question the wars they're sent to fight, whether they're worth fighting, whether they're winnable, or whether they're ethical, because 2019 was an important year, and it just culminated, right? Just ended. 2019 year was the first year, the 18th of the Afghan War. It was the first year where the U.S. and its allies, mostly through airstrikes, caused more civilian casualties than the Taliban, than the anti-government forces. Now, why is that never spoken about in the adulation of our military, in the adulation of really these wars, or the apathy about these wars? You know, my ex-wife behind my back, we live in the Kansas area, emailed the Kansas City Royals and got me on the Jumbotron. I was the every game, 162 games a year, right? 81 of them at home. They honor a soldier, and pictures of the soldier go across the Jumbotron. I didn't know. She thought she was going to surprise me, and she had good intentions. But I wanted to go vomit in a trash bin afterwards. I was embarrassed. This was the exact opposite of what I wanted. And I'm not saying that it's wrong if you do want that adulation, but my point is, I had much more nuanced and complex feelings and doubts about these wars and my own behavior in them. And I thought it was a gross miscarriage to just adulate me without questioning the framing of the war, or, like today, the fact that we've crossed the tipping point where we're killing more Afghan civilians than the Taliban, the evil Taliban. That's that. I think that's rather profound.
You know, the other night in our class, when you spoke here at USC, you mentioned an incident that I was last night, actually, and I couldn't sleep after, and nor could my wife, because she heard it. And you describe, because we have a great belief in our technology of death and war. It's precise. It can avoid civilians. It avoids bad things. It's not, you know, it's sort of a clean kind of war now, particularly with drones. You know, occasionally we wipe out a whole wedding party or something. But you talked about one day in Iraq calling in a strike on a building and with precision. Could you just tell that story?
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, a sniper had hit two soldiers in the unit, had a pretty good idea. I was correct. The window that was responsible or that the shot came from worked really hard with the pilot to get a precision strike from a Hellfire missile. And, you know, I don't totally understand the structure of buildings or exactly what's going to happen. I'm not a scientist or an architect or an engineer. And, you know, the front face of this building came down and, you know, the accusation, and I think it was correct, from a person carrying a child's body was that we had caused this casualty, and I'm certain that I did, and that's mine, right? That's me to live with that, you know, civilian death. It's not the first time I've caused it, and I will tell you that this notion of technological precision is a farce. Okay, sure, our missiles are more precise than they were in World War II, but then why are thousands of civilians dying in drone strikes and in airstrikes? Why did a Marine Corps colonel, an experienced pilot, by mistake, drop a bomb that was supposed to be dropped on the Taliban on the center of one of my outposts, one of my platoon's small strong points? And my best friend is coming up to visit today, and he was in that outpost, and the bomb was dropped on him, and I was sure he was dead, and he didn't die. But three of our Afghan allies were killed. This is so easy to make a mistake. These weapons are not precise, and they're still human error. A colonel with 20 years of experience who wasn't really punished, right? And I don't even really blame him. I'm not angry. He put the wrong grid in. He did the wrong calculation from the grid system to the longitude latitude. This is not precision. There are many civilian casualties.
But let's talk about, end with a discussion of precise torture, precise death, and accountability. Because this investigation by the International Criminal Court was really struck a raw nerve with three different administrations, Democratic and Republican, Obama, Trump, right, and Bush, because it began looking into enhanced interrogation, which we still don't have agreement that is torture, okay? And in fact, John Wood, a guy who in the Justice Department who defined it as not torture and used this language, he's a professor of law at UC Berkeley and leads a respectable life and so forth. So here, all these years later, the International Criminal Court, under a brave prosecutor, today when we're doing this interview, finally got permission from the International Criminal Court. That's how wild and reckless they are in making charges against the U.S. It's taking them all this time, right, for 18 years, really, almost the length of the war, to look into what was done by the United States, as well as the Taliban in Afghanistan. And it begins, and where the prosecutor says she's got a great deal of evidence, that's why the court has decided to let her go ahead, it goes back to the torture program, a program actually captured very effectively in a documentary by Alex Gibney called Taxi to the Dark Side, where someone who was literally wanted to be a taxi driver ends up you know, going through this nightmarish experience. And you were in that country, and I'm not saying you participated in torture, but I mean, here, let's take a few minutes, just kind of consider the poetry of this thing. here's a country that we knew next to nothing about. We helped mess up. We aren't the only ones that was messed up by the Soviets and by the British and just about every other major civilization. And what do? We don't intervene when we in fact bring terrorists and radical Mujahideen and Islamists there. And they end up, oh, we're now interested because they blew up these towers in New York. If they had blown up, you know, a lot of other things in the world, we'd been less interested. And so then we invade the wrong country. We invade Iraq, which had nothing to do with it, showing our lack of serious purpose. And then we invade there. And from the very beginning, in the name of bringing democracy and freedom to a country, we establish or support a standard of torture not easily associated with most nations going to war that claim to be advanced in their values.
Well, absolutely. So almost immediately upon embarking on this war on terror, you know, Dick Cheney did say on live television, I believe it was Meet the Press, that we're going to have to utilize the dark side. And of course, we immediately did. You mentioned John Yoo and these legal memos that allowed enhanced interrogation techniques, really a euphemism for torture. And what's interesting is, you know, the Justice Department sort of unilaterally said this is legal without any real oversight from the supposedly co-equal branches, right, especially the judicial branch. What we have is no accountability because guys like John Yoo and the guys who instituted this program, they're walking free with great jobs, right, most of them living comfortable lives. I mean, just show you the farce of this torture program that is really partly under investigation because much of it was initially utilized in Afghanistan and then at Guantanamo. I mean, we paid millions and tens of millions of dollars to contractors, two guys, Mitchell was the name of one of them, to implement this torture regime. And these guys had no expertise, either in the Arab world, Muslim world, or in really torture. I mean, these guys, they were not experts, and there's been no accountability for them either. You know, one of the reasons that this prosecutor, this brave prosecutor, says that 2003 and 4, while not the only important years, might be the key years where she has the most evidence, at least against the American side of the three that she's investigated, is connected to the Iraq War, is connected to this farce of America just not being serious and attacking all kinds of people with nothing to do with it. When 2003 and 4 was happening, 9 out of 10 American soldiers deployed were deployed in Iraq, not Afghanistan. We actually dropped to troop levels around 20,000. And so how do you implement American military interests if you don't even have more than one or two infantry brigades on the ground in a country that's bigger than Iraq? Well, you utilize special forces teams and CIA agents to back these warlord militias. And so that's why I think, based on my reading and research, that 2003 and 4, a lot of the worst war crimes were allegedly and most likely, I would argue, committed because we didn't have a lot of soldiers on the ground, so we utilized these other forces. And again, so did my soldiers commit war crimes? To my knowledge, no, at least not really. I mean, you know, certain, it depends how you define collateral damage, as we call it, or just civilian casualties. But I did see the Afghan army do it as a matter of course, and they were our allies. And so are we accountable for that? Well, we trained them. They used our weapons and everything. So, you know, I think that this entire story is so instructive, and it'll pass, right? It'll pass out of the media by the time this publishes, maybe, unfortunately. But I can't think of it. I'm glad we're recording on this subject on this day because I can't think of a better vignette, a better subject to illustrate the nature of America's absurd war on terror and the war crimes inherent of it, in it, in starting the war and then in prosecuting the war.
Okay, and let's talk last few sentences about accountability, because we started by saying, here's Donald Trump, obviously a dangerous buffoon. It's hard to be too objective or pretend to. Clearly, this guy is insensitive in the least to any notion of civil liberty and limits of power of government, which after all was supposed to be the great hope of the American experiment, limited government, you know, a fear of government power, power corrupts, etc. But let's talk about the good people. We had a Senate intelligence investigation, Senator Dianne Feinstein. And someone who, you know, give her credit, she actually, and there's a very good documentary about it.
It's a feature movie, The Report. Very excellent.
Yeah, a really important movie. And one investigator working for her Senate committee, the Special Intelligence Committee, which was started actually to look at abuse from the CIA, going back to the Church Committee. But nonetheless, for over years of study of this report, and including the CIA breaking into the Senate computer system and everything else, they come up with this report about the torture program. And it includes torture in Afghanistan as well as elsewhere, and by the CIA, and by these two psychologists who really didn't have much professional expertise, but somehow devised this program, and it's gruesome as heck. To this day, we have not been able to read that report. We've been able to read a redacted version of the summary or the introduction of the report, okay? And yet, when whistleblowers like Edward Snowden tell us what we need to know, they're condemned by these very same people like Dianne Feinstein and, you know, Joe Biden and others as traitors and so forth. So we don't get that information, right? We don't hold these people accountable. There is nothing within our own system that, no checks and balances. And then, and this really cuts to the heart of the argument about the International Criminal Court. The International Criminal Court was set up when nations fail to do their due diligence and hold their own elite, their own military, their own power structure accountable. You have an International Criminal Court to say, you in the Sudan went too far. We're now going to have an international tribunal to look at it. And at that moment, these same people in the U.S. Congress, and you mentioned them before, but we should mention it was Joe Biden there and Dianne Feinstein, knowing about their own government's ability and eagerness to cover up war crimes. They know that because Dianne Feinstein had to fight to get any of this report on torture out. And yet when an international court says they're going to look at it, they then pass legislation not only preventing it, but saying that the U.S. government would be authorized to what? Even go to war with the international court. Why don't you summarize this thing for people who couldn't quite capture that argument? Tell us what Dianne Feinstein or Joe Biden's vote really intended. What did it lead to?
Well, there is, as you mentioned, no accountability for U.S. war criminals. In fact, if you turn on MSNBC today, you are likely to see a former war criminal or someone who was complicit in war crimes, like John Brennan, for example, as a commentator. That's the punishment, is you get a paid gig. I can think, actually, of no country that is more appropriate to investigate than the United States because we don't hold people accountable. And let me just say that I think the greatest sin of the Obama administration, of many, but the one that is rarely mentioned, was his immediate decision not to what he called look backwards and prosecute or even investigate any Bush-era war crimes, because he set a precedent that we don't question what we did later, right? If America did it, we're gonna forget about that sad chapter and we're going to move on and commit new war crimes, which, of course, Obama's administration is. What Joe Biden and company, Schumer, Clinton, McConnell, Kerry, what these, and you know, Feinstein and Boxer, what these guys and gals voted for, and women voted for, was a bill that at its logical extremist conclusion said that we are above the law to such an extent that should the ICC dare to investigate or, in an extreme case, actually indict or hold one of our soldiers, we will go to war. We will invade a NATO ally. We will invade a NATO ally and break him out of prison, essentially. And I just want to emphasize again that this is because the United States doesn't hold its generals and its intelligence agents accountable for these crimes. And it's interesting. And I really want to end on this, because I don't want to leave this conversation without saying, you brought up Washington and Eisenhower, and there's an interesting dynamic in American history. It's often generals, former generals, it's often military men who who say some of the more profound or at least more famous and publicized critiques of all of this. So you had Washington warning against fake patriots, right? And then you have Eisenhower warning against the military-industrial complex. But it was a whole lot of guys. I mean, General and then President Grant, another West Point graduate, was against the Mexican War that he served in. He said it was one of the great crimes of his life. He said, I had a horror of the Mexican War, only I didn't have the courage to resign. It has often been military men who've actually seen combat, right? Not necessarily guys who graduated first in their class and saw none. It has often been the guys who've seen the most combat who, at some point in their careers, have warned us. And we have ignored their warnings to the detriment of what's left of this ostensible republic.
Well, that's it for this edition of Sheer Intelligence. I've been talking to Danny Shorson. Check out his books. You can go on Amazon now and order his book on patriotism, which really raises the prospect of patriotism being toxic. And he is one of these in the tradition of Eisenhower and Washington, a person of who served his country 18 years. He's a young guy. He's 36 years old. 18 of those 36 years were spent in the U.S. military, beginning with West Point and Iraq duty and Afghanistan. And he offers a warning. First of all, it's a stark warning. And we do it on this day when President Trump has said, and his Secretary of State and John Bolton, who was his advisor and now is a darling of Democrats, that the International Criminal Court is itself a criminal enterprise that can be wiped out. This is anarchy. It's madness. But we had the reminder today, this is bipartisan. And his likely opponent, not Bernie Sanders, who voted against it. This is not an editorial. It's just a statement of fact. Nancy Pelosi also voted against it. But Joe Biden did vote for it. And we should recognize that it had enormous bipartisan support. And basically, what we have bipartisan agreement on is not allowing anything we do to be subject to serious international inquiry, even when it's in The Hague. We're not talking about giving Beijing authority, you know. It's really quite startling. But that's something we're going to have to explore more in the future. I want to thank Krista Ho at KCRW for posting these things where they carry our show. And here, Sebastian Grubar at the University of Southern California Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism, who's been our engineer. Tasha Hakimi Zapata writes up these interviews in ways that make them more interesting for people. And Joshua Scheer is the director and the producer, the man in charge of creating Scheer Intelligence. See you next week with another edition. Rien de rien. Non, je ne regrette rien. Ni le bien. Allumer le feu, mes chagrins, mes plaisirs, je n'ai plus besoin d'eux. Balayer les amours avec leur trémolo, balayer pour toujours.